Brothers, sisters, guests, assalamu alaikum. Very happy to welcome today my old friend, Dr. Ang Swee Chai. Ang has been, let's start from the beginning. She's born in Penang, in Malaysia, and spent most of her young life in Singapore, and she has been in the UK since 1966. Whilst in the UK, she got information about happenings in Palestine and Lebanon, and she got attracted, and because she is an orthopedic surgeon, she decided to go there to help after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And during that time, she came to know the Palestinian people very well and came to love them, and then she founded the Medical Aid for Palestinians, which is what she is still working with. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, during her time in Lebanon, she was also there when the massacre in Sabra and Shatila happened, and she is a witness to that. She has written a book on that massacre as well. So I felt that it's good that we could invite her to come and share some of her experiences with us in this audience. I would like to invite her.
Thank you very much for asking me to come. And it is a big honor to be with you this evening, especially during your prayers. And it brought back the memories of my time in Lebanon. The day about a few weeks after the massacre, when we actually went to Saida and I had a chance to visit a mosque and listen to all the prayers, and it helped me a lot regain my belief in God and His goodness and His mercy. I'll start from the beginning. This is an old talk show, and as you can see, this slide was first put together in 1982 when I came back from the Middle East, my first trip. And as you can see from it, that there's mold and there's fungus growing on it. It's very old. And as the years go by, more and more slides are added on. And but today I'm not going to show you the whole lot, because otherwise we'll be here till midnight. But I just show you some of it. I've called it From Beirut to Jerusalem, because within my own heart, I share this fervent wish that one day the Palestinians will be able to return from the refugee camps of Lebanon into Lebanon, that my friends can go back to Al-Aqsa and pray as their forefathers have. It's something which they all want to do, but they can't do now. A little bit of my background. Brother Iqbal introduced me very well, but I just tell you the other bit of me he didn't introduce properly. I was somewhere when I was in medical school, I became a Christian. I was baptized and I became part of a church that's very, very pro-Israel. In other words, I supported Israel for many reasons. Firstly, I thought that the Jewish people were persecuted during the Second World War and before. They suffered so much. So therefore, they deserve a home in Israel. Secondly, the Bible, the way I understood it long time ago, was that they talk about the Israeli people as being the chosen people of God. And then thirdly, Israel has put itself forward as a democracy in the Middle East. And if you stay a long time in the UK and read a British newspaper, that's what you believe. So one day when I came back in 1982 from the hospital, I was working in St. Thomas's then as a youngly qualified surgeon, and I went home, I switched on the television, and I saw airplanes dropping bombs on a place called Lebanon. Of course, that time I was not clear what Lebanon, where it was, but Israel was clear. Those planes were Israelis, they were flown by Israeli pilots, and they were dropping bombs and destroying a place called Lebanon. And I began to ask myself, is this the Israel that I understood it to be? Is this the beacon of democracy in the Middle East? Is this the chosen people of God? How can they kill innocent children? And I began to ask questions. I asked my Christian friends, there was no answer. They said that there was Muslim terrorists, PLO, and therefore Israel has gone to flush them up. I asked around my Jewish friends, I couldn't get an answer. But I know within my heart that this is not the way of God. I began to pray, and I prayed, and I prayed. And one day, in early August 1982, about 10 weeks after Israel invaded Lebanon, a request came for a surgeon to go and work in a refugee camp to look after the wounded. And I know that this is what I must do, and I resigned from my work, my job in St. Thomas's Hospital, and took a plane with the relief team and arrived in Lebanon. As you can see, these were some of the bombs that Israel had, and killing many people. And when I arrived in Lebanon, the newspaper in those days are as unreliable as today. They portrayed the whole war in Lebanon, Israeli invasion, as Muslim versus Christian, and therefore and terrorist versus democracy. The PLO were terrorists, they were Muslim, they're fanatics, they're hijackers, and Israel are the good guys. And it is that kind of logic. But when you actually went to Lebanon, you find that that's not the case at all. Because this was a Christian convent that they put us up while we are waiting for Israel to stop bombarding Muslim Beirut, South Lebanon, so that the medical team, that 56 of us, can cross into West Beirut to look after the wounded. So finally, the ceasefire came after about 36 hours, and we were able to make our way across the main line. And then this was a Beirut I knew. The Beirut which for weeks before I've watched on television, blocks and blocks of buildings being bombed out and destroyed. Only this time, real, life-size, three-dimensional, and frightening. The coastline of the beautiful city of Beirut, also known as the Pearl of the Middle East, was shelled by Israeli gunboats and reduced to wreckage. But more frightening are the number of new weapons they tested in Lebanon. That time is the first time Israel exploded phosphorus bombs, so that when the phosphorus hits someone, it just burns for day and day, and then if you wash it, it will burn even more, and the victims just died of phosphorus burns. But this is a different kind. This is called a vacuum bomb. What happened is that the bomb would go into a center, build a very, very high TNT value, and suck the whole building down. This is an 11-floor building that was sucked into a heap of rubble, burying within it 200 people. When I arrived and saw this for myself, I know that a doctor can't do much. It is a very humbling experience. I could do nothing to help those people who were buried and killed in this one single bomb attack. Shortly after my arrival, the PLO agreed to evacuate. Israel said that if the PLO left Lebanon, then it would stop bombing Beirut city, would lift the siege so that food and medicine can reach the people. And so with this, the international peacekeeping force, there were five countries backing the evacuation and the peace truce. And these were familiar countries, as France, Italy, UK, USA, and one more country. But on that day itself, the evacuation of PLO, it was early in the morning. I just arrived, this was after maybe about 10 days, and suddenly there was a lot of noise and there was firing of machine gun. And I got out and saw that the streets of Beirut were packed with people and large big posters were up everywhere. The city of Beirut has come to say goodbye to the evacuating Palestinians. Of course, at that time, being a born-again fundamentalist Christian, I cannot understand why the people of Beirut, the people of Lebanon, love the Palestinians, and why is the Palestinian who are evacuating so drawn to the people of Beirut. And if you look at the words, you can't see it very well. It says, "I love you, Beirut." Ayub is one of the Palestinians that go away, he's put his name in. "I love you, Beirut. Good luck. Goodbye." And obviously, this is not the image that our newspaper described them. We talk about terrorists, we talk about fanatics and hijackers, but these are the people who love the Lebanese in Beirut, and the people in Lebanon love them too. Now, of course, now, 22 years after the fact, I can tell you what is it all about. 14,000 Palestinians were forced to leave Lebanon within the evacuation, which means that 14,000 families have been broken up, because each family will have given up their man, and it's either a father or an elder son or somebody important, leaving behind women with young children and old people with no man to look after them. And in the Middle Eastern culture, this is a catastrophe. You see, you can imagine if you take 14,000 family, and from this family you take the older son out, you take the father and force them to leave and never to come back. And that was the price Israel demanded from the PLO in order to stop the bombing. So when the PLO evacuated, it happened. The bombs stopped. Peace came back. People who are hiding in bomb shelters were allowed to go home and start picking up their lives. And I was seconded by the International Red Cross to join a group called the Palestine Red Crescent Society. Now, this is quite a culture shock to me, because I'm joining a Red Crescent, a Muslim organization, but it was a beginning of a road, beginning of a journey, beginning of a way where I learned. And that is my ID card, which I cherish, saying that I'm a member of the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which I proudly cherish. And they took me to a hospital called the Gaza Hospital. Now, you know that Gaza is actually in the occupied Palestinian territory, inside Palestine itself, but this is actually in Beirut and inside the refugee camp. And that's where I learned the story. The Palestinians have lost their home in 1948, when the state of Israel was declared. 750,000 Palestinians were forced out of their homes, and these people walked many, many miles with their young children across the boundaries. Some of them walked into Jordan, some of them walked into Egypt, some of them walked into Syria, and my friends in Lebanon walked into Beirut. From 1948 to 1952, these people waited for the world to come to a solution, for them to return home. They never did. The United Nations put them in tents. I think just refugee tents, but over the years, the refugee tents become permanent homes. So that by the time it was 1982, the Palestinians had been there for three generations. And in these refugee camps, they built hospitals. Now, in order to remember their home, they call it Gaza, after the Gaza Strip. They call it Haifa, they call it Ramallah, and they call it after the places in Palestine where they came from. And this was Gaza Hospital. It was protected by the International Red Cross. Despite that, Gaza Hospital has been bombed. It was 11 floors high and the top two floors were blown off. The doctors' quarters were shelled. But after the evacuation, the bomb stopped. So Gaza Hospital was being cleaned up and refurbished. At that time, the Palestine Red Crescent Society ran 13 clinics and 9 hospitals. And the Israelis had selectively bombed and destroyed every single of the hospitals and clinics, killing patients, killing doctors and so on. So if you, I really don't know. I know my, some people get very angry with me when I say, it looks as though they have a map saying that this is a PRCS hospital, therefore it's a Palestinian target, therefore you bomb it. Now, it's no longer looking like that. But that was 1982. This was Sabra Shatila camp. And this was a photograph which I took from the 6th floor of Gaza Hospital. It is interesting because at that time, I didn't know what is a Palestinian refugee camp. And I didn't realize that this was Sabra and Shatila. So I stood there and I looked. And I just saw blocks and blocks of buildings. But of course, this was a refugee camp. It was at that time the home of 120,000 Palestinian refugees. And it is here, and not in the textbooks or the newspapers in the Western world, where the Palestinian story was written and taught to me. After each day, I walk up and down the refugee camp, and I looked, and I see new families coming back with their young children, coming back to rebuild their life. Many of these families have already lost their husbands or their sons, but they brought back the young children, the grandparents, and they wanted to start life all again. And I saw them clean up their houses which were all blown apart. And for the first time, I realized how wonderful these people are, because they're generous, they're hospitable, they're kind, they are no terrorists at all. They are God-fearing people. They pray, and they pray the way you pray. Despite what happened to them, they never blame God. It's a strange, strange culture. And if you look at them, you know they have been through hell, because these are people who have lost their home in Palestine. They have been pushed around in Lebanon, and even within the refugee camps, they have been bombarded, and they have to leave the refugee camps, and now when they come back to the refugee camps, they found their home all blown up. And you can see, in fact, on top, the building and the roofs are all gone. But yet, within these refugee camps, the women will explain to me the story of Palestine. They will embroider Palestinian design. Well, that's where I learned. Palestine was never a desert, because the women were so oranges on their embroidery, and said, look, my village was an orange grove. You know Jaffa oranges? We planted them generations before the Israelis came. Look at the green. That is our garden. And Jerusalem is a beautiful, beautiful city, you see. And within that, I learned many things. I learned about the history of Palestine. I also learned how to cook Arabic coffee. And I learned to speak some kind of Arabic, which nobody understands, of course. And so for 3 weeks, I was very happy. I was sad as well, because I kept asking myself, can it be true that all these people were the terrorists that newspapers called? Is this true, you know? But anyway, there was a lot of work to do, because the wounded all came back. The hospital was filled up and crowded. So, right, that was 3 weeks. Suddenly, on the 15th of September, something horrible happened. There was 3 weeks of peace, and then suddenly, the International Peacekeeping Force decided to withdraw. And with the, we of course were a little bit, we're not too worried, we just thought that, well, they have been around and the peace is holding, so they withdrew. But on the 15th of September, on that morning, 5 a.m., planes flew in. And we know that it's bad news, because it has to be Israeli planes, because Beirut Airport was closed, and it has to be Israel. They flew in, and then tanks began to roll in from South Lebanon, because Israel is south of Lebanon. But 500-600 tanks assembled themselves and drove themselves, shelled all the way from South Lebanon into Beirut City. Now, before this, Beirut City was surrounded by Israeli tanks, but never invaded like that. The Israelis have bombed Beirut from the air, and they have sieged and denied water and medicine to the people. But this time the tanks have come in, and you can see the tank shelling beginning. You can see the mosque in South Lebanon, South Beirut, and that was the first shell that fell from the south. It was an Israeli tank, and then it began to surround the refugee camp and in all directions. By about midday, there were streams of shell smoke coming from everywhere, and everybody was very frightened, knowing that something horrible is going to happen. So there was gunfight, and to make life more confusing, because if you were in a situation like Beirut and you don't speak a lot of Arabic and people were frightened, you listen to the BBC World Service, and as usual, the news was IDF spokesman said that the IDF has gone into West Beirut to get the 2,000 PLO terrorists left in the refugee camps. Now that's what the news was. I'm very, people can't understand why now, 22 years after that, I still talk like that. It is so important, because if you're all over the world and you know that something is happening, and 600 Israeli tanks and Israeli planes have flown into West Beirut, violating the peace treaty, there must be an excuse for it. The excuse is that the PLO has left 2,000 terrorists and Israel has gone in to get them. But this is what happened. I was in a refugee camp, and I can tell you what happened. The next morning, early in the morning, after prayer time, women went to the wells and the water point to get water for the family. And right there, they were shot. Some of them killed. This was the first lady that came in with her elbow blown off. It was her x-ray. And following her, a lot of people were shot in their homes, and they were brought into the hospital. Many of them died in the mortuary, and they were by no means terrorists. There were people like that. This was an old man that lived next to the hospital. I know him very well. They killed him. Young children like that were died for no reason. My own nurses was also shot, and by about evening the next day, the whole hospital was teeming with people, about 3,000 people fleeing in the hospital, saying that gunmen has broken into the homes of the people in the camp and start shooting up families. They were very, very frightened. They were hoping that by staying in the hospital, somehow, because of the foreign doctors and the International Red Cross observer status, that they would be protected. But that was not true, of course. And at night, this was, the machine gun noises still continued, and the skies of the refugee camps were lit with military flares. And we know that these were Israeli flares shot into the air to light up the refugee camps so that whatever operations would continue. And of course, by then, we knew that they were going to people's homes and killing whole families. So, it went on like that for 72 hours, and meanwhile, the medical team like myself and all that were operating downstairs, and many patients died. We ran out of medical supply, there was no blood, and everybody was very frightened. On a Saturday morning, the 18th of September, a tank came in and ordered all foreigners out of the hospital at gunpoint. That was the time when we were very worried, because we thought that if we were gone, they would probably come in and kill our patients. But at the same time, you cannot argue with a machine gun, and you would just force out. And as I came out of the hospital, I saw groups of women and men and children all rounded up by soldiers. And while I was passing them, one woman tried to give me her baby, but that was not allowed, and she was forced to take the baby back. And I feared the worst, because for many days afterwards, I came back looking for the mother and child. I couldn't find any of them. At that time, for the first time, we were out from the basement operating theater, and we can see what has happened. For the 3 days, while we were operating, trying to save a few lives, the people of the camp were massacred, killed, their bodies rotting there. That was the first time when I actually had to confront the truth. Because even up to then, I was not sure whether I was confused. Palestinian terrorists, Palestinian people, Palestinian refugee. But that morning, I know who were the victims and who were the criminals. Because if you look at each single person killed, these are people who actually were not fighters. They're Palestinian refugees, they're people. And there's no one at that moment in time that can say that Palestinians do not exist. Because if you remember, I think the younger ones don't remember that. In the 1970s, 1980s, there was this big hoo-ha about there were no people called the Palestinian people. They're only Palestinian terrorists. But on that morning, through their death, they actually fought and won themselves human status. And also, the homes that people came in to rebuild were again destroyed. And if you look at these houses, you'll find that the paint is still fresh. It's just painted and probably not even dry. And if you go beyond the broken walls, you find that the families were broken. There were no one left. Food were half eaten. Furnitures were half smashed up. Yet the people gone, buried in mass graves. These are mass graves. And you can see that what happened is that these are tank tracks. They just dug up shallow grave and they buried all the bodies in the rubble. And the houses, they just bulldozed up all the houses. Actually, if you have been watching the television, it's very much like Jenin recently in Palestine, but on a bigger scale. About 3,000 people were killed in those 3 days. And this mass grave alone, 1,000 bodies were buried there. There were orphans everywhere. And as you walk around, you see children standing in front of walls with bullet holes all over, where their families were lined up and killed. And also children without home, with nowhere to go for the winter. I want to talk to you about this family because it is such a typical and yet painful event. This family was from, I don't know whether you're familiar, there are Palestinians who are within the Green Line and Palestinians who are in the refugee camps in occupied Palestinian territory. These people were from a village near Jerusalem. It's completely, their village is gone, doesn't exist anymore. And when Israel was formed, they actually found themselves in South Lebanon. South Lebanon was bombed, and so the family found themselves in another refugee camp called Tel Azata in East Beirut. From Tel Azata refugee camp, the family, after Tel Zata was, there was another massacre, that was in 1978, Tel Zata was massacred, 3,000 people died. So this family escaped from Telazata and found themselves in Shatila camp. When the evacuation took place, the family had enough. They said, we are going to stay. So they stayed in Shatila camp. And the massacre came, and of the whole family, 27 members were killed. This is Munir. At the time, Munir was only 9 years old. And Munir was shot 3 times, together with 27 members of his family. And as the dead bodies fell on him, he fainted. Which was a good thing, because then the gunman thought he died and left him alone. And after they left, his friends came and took him to the hospital. So this is Munir. I talked to you about Munir because I visited Munir's grandmother. His grandmother at the time was in South Lebanon. And when she heard that there was a massacre in Shatila, the old lady was very worried. So she walked. She walked 20 kilometers all the way from South Lebanon to Shatila camp. And when she arrived, she knew that her family was gone. And Hajar was mourning for her family, but I went into her house, basically because she's Munir's grandmother, and I asked her, what have you to say, Hajar? And then she broke out and told me all this in Arabic. She says, what's there left to say? There's nothing left to say. She said, our flowers still blossom, and our oranges give fragrance. Our sparrows sing their usual songs, yet my children are nowhere to be found. Beirut, you took all I had, and you took my last hope in life. My heart lies dead on your streets. Abu Zuhair, my fine young son, was cruelly cut off his roots on your soil. Abu Zuhair, you who found your way from Telazata with a crushing cough in your hand to meet me in Shatila, how come you are slaughtered by a sheep? What have I got to say? Crow of ill omen, please, who told you of my whereabouts? Bearers of coffin, please move slowly so that I can see my loved ones once again. Oh God, please wait, just wait, and your will be done. How I envy those of you who were around when my children died. Did you let them die thirsty, or were you kind enough to give them a drink? Life, what life is left to us? Our hearts have died and our tears have dried for all the men and women who have died. God Almighty, give us patience, and my children, may our love be a lantern to your path, and may God show you the holy way. Doctor, please go away. You've reopened all our wounds. We are so weary. What's there left to say? So that was. Again, I have to go through all this with you because you will find many people who say that Palestinians or Arabs or Muslims has got different values. They put their children out to die so that they can make good propaganda. This is not true. Because I share her grief, I can never even imagine that I can experience 10% of what she felt. But that's enough. So that kind of racism, which says that people from the third world, from the Middle East, people, Arabic people, Palestinian people, do not have the same kind of family love is rubbish, and I think it's a sacrilege and a blasphemy to humanity. So it was a sad occasion. I didn't come back to London because it was too much. I've just made new friends. I've just come from a background where everybody kind of vilify the Palestinians, and saw them as terrorists, and suddenly I got to discover for myself who were the terrorists and who were the victims. And I don't know who has died, who hasn't, and 3,000 Palestinians have been killed. The bodies were there, and I don't even know whether my friends are alive or not, so I decided to stay on. And every day I go back to the refugee camps, to the hospital, and we walk up and down, and each time we find a little mass grave, and we find bodies. Sometimes by that time, we are talking about October, it's decaying, and the stench was horrendous, and you can't even recognize the bodies, but usually you find an identity card or a piece of jewelry or something like that, and the families identified the body, took it back, buried it, and was crying. And one day something good happened, because this boy, whom I treated just before the massacre, spotted me. Little Mahmoud came up and started to put his arms around me, Dr. Sui, Dr. Sui. And I said, oh, Mahmoud. Then he said, oh yeah, we saw the soldiers took you, all your foreigners, and took you to the UN building, and that's where they killed everybody, so I thought you were dead. And so he was so happy, and he started to cry. And I realized that poor Mahmoud has lost his family. He was then an orphan. And suddenly, a whole lot of children, children from everywhere, Palestinian children, begin to crowd around me, and the little girl say, Doctor, can you take a picture of us? And I said, of course I will. You must take a picture of us now, because there's a Shatila camp. Tomorrow, maybe the camp will be destroyed, and there'll be no more Shatila. But at least today, we are here, and you can take a picture, and you can show your friend all over the world this refugee camp, and show them we are the children of Shatila. And as I begin to focus the camera, they suddenly put their hands up and make the victory sign and said, and we are not afraid. This picture was taken in October 1982. Since then, I've been back to Lebanon many times, and each time I go back, I carry a stack of these pictures, hoping that I can find them. But of course, I never found any of these children. But now looking back, I realized that they didn't ask me to bring the pictures back to them. They said to take the picture and show it to the whole world, to show the whole world how the Palestinian children of Shatila camp were not afraid. So I'm showing it to you now. Of course, with the massacre, a lot of public outcry, and that within Israel itself, 500,000 people demonstrated, and the Israeli had to hold a commission of inquiry, and some of us, the three of us from Gaza Hospital, went down to testify. And that time, you know that the commission found a certain area, Sharon, not fit for any official minister duty. That was 1982. Of course, that's history now, people have forgotten. So from then on, we came back to London, and some of us got together, and we formed a charity called Medical Aid for Palestinians. There are many reasons why we started a charity ourselves, we can talk about later on, but it's so important that even if we can't do them anything, we can at least call an organization Medical Aid for Palestinians. Because even up to now, the Palestinians haven't got a Palestine, but they are real people, and we want their names to be remembered. Within a few months of our formation, the Palestinians were again attacked. There was another camp war. Many of my friends were killed. And this time they were under siege, so they were not allowed. The bodies had to be buried in the mosque, and I know how you feel. Bodies should never be buried in the mosque, but the martyrs have nowhere to be buried. So that's what happened. These are young people, as you can see. And it was bad because Gaza Hospital was burned, and it was difficult to look after patients. We had to do operations without masks, without gloves, without electricity. Of course, then the news, you know, working with the Palestinians is like that. Every time some disaster happened to the Palestinian, the truth gets out. And when people know about it, people want to support. So because of all these disasters, more and more people want to volunteer and help NAB, including this 80-year-old lady who came from Germany, and all she wanted to do was to get this van and drive around all the refugee camps and the displaced people and give them milk. So she was 82, and at first I didn't want her to join the team because 82 is not very young, and you know, Beirut is not the kind of place where you take an 82-year-old lady out. We said, no, 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 I got an ambulance, you don't have to worry about it. Oxfam is going to give me the milk. The water is free, so I'm here. And of course, the children love her, and they call her, her name is Rita, so she's Mama Rita. And from Mama Rita becomes Mama Hali. That means the milk mother. So 1987, we were still working in Shatila, but Shatila camp has become like that. And 1987 was also the United Nations International Year of Shelter. So hundreds of resolutions were passed about how everybody has a right to a home and so forth. And that has bypassed the Palestinian people. The refugee camps were destroyed, not rebuilt. People live in this, and when the rains fall, the whole lot collapse, and all of them have to be evacuated into shelters like this. All partitioned. So these are abandoned buildings, and the United Nations will just put up black curtains, and within each black curtain will be a family. So the cycle has completed from people in Palestine into tents in Lebanon, and then they converted their tents into cities. The cities were destroyed, and now their children are back living behind this kind of shelters. It was grim and depressing with no future, and yet it was in 1987 in one of these shelters that we learned of the first Palestinian Intifada, the first uprising. The Palestinian under occupation in Gaza and West Bank has decided that to oppose the occupation and rose up against the Israeli occupation. This was Gaza. These were the women of Gaza and the children of Gaza. They were demonstrating before Israeli tanks. Now it takes a lot of courage to be standing before Israeli tanks who can actually just shell them and kill them. But they are not afraid. So it is a very special moment when ordinary people stood up against a mighty military force. And if I might be wrong, but I think the Israeli army is the fourth largest army in the whole world in terms of armaments and firepower. Of course, the Intifada, because it was massive and it went on for so long, brought attention to the whole world. Now, this is a Palestinian refugee living in Jabalia camp. But that day, Abu Muhammad has taken me to this heap of rocks. That was his grandfather's home. The Israeli came, dynamited it, put a prohibition so that nobody from his family can go and live there or rebuild there. Now, the interesting thing is, all around it, trees were planted. And every year, millions of American pilgrims visit the Holy Land and they look at the trees planted by Israel. But it was only the Intifada who actually made some of them look at the bulldozed building and the rubble and the homes that have been destroyed so that the trees could be planted. And also they have to see the refugee camps where the sun never comes through. And meet children who have got no future, who are born refugee, who will grow up refugees, and will die refugees. And of course, these television scenes of the Israelis beating up Palestinians It was in 1987, 88, 91, 92, and now it is again the same thing happening. And of course, it's so important. I mean, I don't have to labor the point because I'm not talking to an American audience tonight, but this is very important. I put it there to show the whole world how Palestinians look like. They are human beings. They are the children of God, like all of us. And of course, this is inside Jerusalem, the occupation, where anybody, Israeli soldiers, can beat up anybody or shoot anybody and arrest anybody. Curfews, okay, barbed wires, sealing up a whole village, denying them any right of leaving the village, or even locking up the windows for days and days. There's no need to have a reason to put a curfew in a village. You just declare a curfew, so everybody will be back into the houses. They cannot look out, children cannot laugh, and then the Israelis will go into the houses and just arrest anybody they like, or demolish the house, blow it up. That is curfew. Again, you know, when you talk about rubber bullets, plastic bullets, tear gas, they all kill. Nowadays, the Israelis don't use this now. This is the second Intifada, they use live bullets. During the first Intifada, because the Palestinians were only throwing stones, they used this. All right, rubber bullets is actually metal. I've taken up the rubber coating on one of them, so it's solid metal. All right, so if you fire point blank, it can actually kill someone, and plastic bullets too. And tear gas shot into a crowded place like that with nowhere to escape can actually kill a whole lot of people. So these are some of the wounded of the Intifada. This chap was fired and shot with a rubber bullet. I'll show you his x-rays. Yeah, this is a kid, again shot. And I don't show where the x-rays are, but the x-ray will show the metal bullet in the head. These are the Palestinians who are working in Ali Arab Hospital, where I worked. And they are wonderful people, because no matter how they suffer, they're still very, very kind. I just feel that, you know, this is a special blessing from God, in the sense that they've suffered so much, yet these people are so kind, they have to be very special. This was after the Ramadan. People have fasted for 40 days. On the day of Eid, everybody was going to the mosque, and the Israelis decided to send their helicopters and shot into the crowds going for prayer. And it was a horrible time for the hospital. 343 people were wounded that day. And after a bad day and a bad night, the next morning, as I was walking back into my quarters to have a wash, I suddenly realized, gosh, Israel tried to destroy Gaza, but yet the flowers have blossomed, the sky was blue, and God has not forgotten the Palestinians of Gaza. Of course, it's a difficult, long struggle, because even up to now, you can see the things that are going on. About 3,500 Palestinians have been killed since the second Intifada. 3,500. And 1,500 homes in the Gaza Strip has been bulldozed and destroyed. The wall was built, destroying Palestinian land. All the olive groves were pulled up, and people were very, very oppressed. They have no rights, no freedom, and each village was built and sealed in so that nobody can go in, nobody can come out without Israeli permit. They're all big prisons. So people ask, how long for? I really don't know. And our Western leaders talk about peace, but they forgot the main ingredient of peace, which is justice. I've known this for a long time. This was peace, Lebanon, 1982. After the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, there were 5 peace plans. All of them failed, because none of the peace plans talk about justice. And today, same. People talk about peace. The roadmap, this, that. But which one of them talk about justice? Certainly there can be no peace without justice. There can be no peace without respect. I have come a long way, and I'm grateful to God that in His mercy He has shown me how wrong I've been. Because from my background, when my church taught that we are right and the Muslims are wrong, the Palestinians are wrong, the Arabs are wrong, that is no way to conduct anything. There's no respect. There's no sense of appreciating each other. Even this, when I came back from Lebanon, my first trip, because I always read the Bible, that would be the Torah, and I think the Muslims will call it the Book of Moses. And I had a problem because according to what my church taught, it says that God wants to bless Isaac. So what happened to Ishmael then? I got a problem. So I've got to go back to the book and read it all over again. And I knew that my church was wrong. They didn't teach me the whole thing. Because it said that God has Ishmael. And Ishmael was blessed. And when Abraham asked Hagar to take Ishmael into the desert, and when he was thirsty, the angel Gabriel came and opened a well for him, and God promised his people that Ishmael will become a powerful person and he will be a leader of many nations. It was in the Torah, it was in the book of Genesis, the Old Testament. So it was our eyes that were blind, who have not seen, who have not read, that within God's world there's room for everyone.